For our second case, it's my pleasure to introduce one of our own, one of our Emory residents. Daniel, why don't you come up here? This is a case of cardiovascular syphilis requiring aortic valve and arch surgical repair in an HIV-infected patient, presented by Daniel Garcia. Daniel.
Thanks, Dr. Rakowski. Good morning, everyone. As she said, I'm Daniel Garcia. I'm a resident here at Emory. I'd like to thank the numerous co-authors you can see on this case. We had a lot of help in trying to make the diagnosis. So this patient initially presented in 2005 to HIV clinic. He was 37 years old, and he came in for evaluation and management of his HIV. At that time, his CD4 count was 91. He was found to have secondary syphilis. It's a little unclear what his other presenting symptoms were at that time. Sounds like maybe a rash of some kind. It's not very well described in the notes, but he did have an RPR with a titer of 1 to 512, and he was treated with penicillin. His RPR titer decreased appropriately to 1 to 64 over several months, and then eventually to 1 to 8. He was initiated on ART a few months after initial diagnosis and treatment. So he followed up in HIV clinic and did very well. By the time I saw him last year, he was coming in for a routine visit. He was feeling well. He mentioned on review systems that he had an irregular heartbeat sometimes, maybe with exercise, maybe at rest, no dyspnea, no chest pain, no other symptoms. It didn't seem to bother him very much. He is MSM. He had some recent unprotected sex. Reports that his partners are HIV positive and on ART. At this time, his HIV is well controlled with a CD4 of nearly 500. His viral load is undetectable, and his ARVs have been changed around due to some vivid dreams with his initial regimen. His exam is notable for a blood pressure of 132 over 53, which by itself isn't that exciting except for the wide pulse pressure. He did have a systolic murmur at the right upper sternal border and an early to mid diastolic decrescendo murmur at the left lower sternal border. And he denied any previous knowledge of murmurs, and no, they were not mentioned previously in any notes. So in the clinic, we got an EKG, which was sinus, didn't have any evidence of LVH or RVH. His serology showed his last positive RPR titer was 1 to 1 in 2013, and he did have some subsequent RPR which were non-reactive. His TPPA was, of course, still reactive. And in 2009, he had undergone an LP with a CSF VDRL, which was negative. So we got an echo, which showed some severe aortic root dilation, up to 6 centimeters at the proximal ascending aorta. As you can see here, the proximal, the aortic root is fairly dilated. You can see the LV is dilated as well. And interestingly, he actually did have moderate to severe aortic regurgitation. It's a little choppy video there. I apologize. But here it's a little clearer. You can see the regurgitant jet directed posteriorly here. So we got a CT angiogram, which showed a fairly large fusiform ascending aortic aneurysm. You can see here in this plane. And in the axial plane, they measured it up to 6.8 centimeters. So he was evaluated by a CT surgery. He got a preoperative angiogram, which showed non-obstructive coronary disease. He underwent successful bioprosthetic aortic valve replacement and hemiarch replacement with a graft. He did very well postoperatively, was just actually discharged after 4 days. He's continued to follow up in clinic and is doing very well, back to his normal activities. There was no significant atherosclerosis noted intraoperatively. His routine cultures, including AFB and fungal cultures on the tissue, were negative. So the pathology, of course, is going to be interesting since we're presenting as a case conference. He did have some nonspecific calcification here. But the pathologist read this as some amorphous areas, including here on low power and here on higher power, that they described as gumma-like with some surrounding inflammation. At this point, we enlisted the help of CDC, and the PCR was negative for T-palidum, and his immunohistochemistry was negative. His TrepTcher EIA was reactive. This is some higher power images showing this inflammation, including a plasma cell here and giant cell involvement here. So these pathology findings are not specific, as we've learned. On the differential include, including tachyosteal arteritis, giant cell arteritis. We felt, given his clinical history, and the fact that clinically he had no symptoms to suggest tachyosteal or giant cell, that this was consistent with cardiovascular syphilis. which, as we discussed, despite the increase that we've seen in primary and secondary syphilis, is not very frequently reported, but may be more common than we realize. And as we've discussed, the aortitis typically involves the thoracic aorta. It's due to an endarteritis of the vasovasorum, the vessel supplying the aortic wall, which leads to disruption of the wall and dilation. The aortic regurgitation is not a common manifestation, but it can occur, as we saw in this case, and it is due to the dilation of the aorta itself and not due to involvement of the aortic cusp. These patients should be evaluated surgically if they're symptomatic, which this patient was not, or if the diameter of their aneurysm is greater than 5.5 centimeters. All comers for thoracic aneurysms tend to grow at least 0.1 centimeters per year, and data in syphilitic aortitis suggests that rupture can occur somewhere in the range of 15 to 30% of cases, but again, some of these data are somewhat old at this point. So as we've seen, this is a fairly challenging definitive diagnosis to make due to the long latency and difficulty in identifying organisms in the pathology. And again, it can present years after the initial diagnosis of presentation and treatment for these patients, and even potentially severe complications such as a large aortic aneurysm in this patient can be asymptomatic. It's unclear if his subjective complaints of maybe some irregular heartbeat were related or not. And so as a result, screening and the physical exam remains essential for detection. So I'd like to thank all the assistance we have in this case. I learned a lot from it, and I appreciate your attention. Thank you.
So another great case, very interesting. So I want to start going back to this guy's history, back in 2005, and he had secondary history. I know that the records are kind of sketchy from back then, and he got a single shot of benzathine penicillin. Hillary, is that what you would have treated him with? And so should he have gotten more therapy?
So it was stated that he had secondary syphilis, so I assume there was a documented rash or other characteristics thereof.
The notes describe secondary syphilis, but secondary syphilis, but they don't describe what his other...
Yeah, I would presume. So if, yes, he would have gotten one shot with the obvious physical findings, hopefully, that were there for secondary syphilis. His CD4 count was pretty low at the time, right, 94? And so you always have to approach patients with HIV and syphilis slightly differently and really evaluate them very well at that time. He had a high RPR, he had a low CD4 count. So that was in 2005. And lumbar puncture would probably have been considered heavily in that patient, though I know at least at our institution we've certainly moved away from that. But his titer was quite high. His CD4 was low, which really puts him in the higher risk group for more widely disseminated T. pallidum. And so he may have gotten a lumbar puncture at that time, which would have changed his treatment. I probably would have done it then. I think that was right before my fellowship. So as I recall, we would have done a lumbar puncture at least.
I would like to ask the other panelists what they would have done. Karen? Dr. Hook, would you have LP'd him in 2005?
Well, first of all, I would have. I think 2.4 million units of penicillin was adequate treatment, and so he was well treated, and I think we validated that with his subsequent response to therapy. I would not have LP'd him. In this day and age, though, we probably would have looked in his eyes. And done vision testing, and as Julie Dombrowski recently published, you know, when we look, we find it. Mm-hmm. And so it would not be surprising if at that point he had some sort of visual problems.
So, I think this comes up to the point that we deal with depending on people that are very familiar with the literature in terms of the CD4 count less than 350 and a high titer, whether you have LP'd. And what we have said with examination of the data, there is a suggestion that there may be somewhat of an increased risk of CSF abnormalities, but there's no data that showed that three shots is better than one. So that's kind of the first point that I wanted to make. Number two, I wanted to ask Daniel whether or not Dr. Hook brought up this issue about his chest x-ray, and was interested in what Dr. Hook talked about a chest x-ray, but I wanted to find out what his chest x-ray was on admission and what the panelists would look for on a chest x-ray that would help you.
If I could interrupt Daniel, sorry, but I think Daniel really presented the most salient point right away, which is that this man had an extraordinarily wide pulse pressure and murmurs of aortic insufficiency, which were the tip-offs as to what's going on in this guy. That was a great starting point. And so no matter what his chest x-ray showed, I will be very interested to hear about it, but I think you would be thinking very quickly about aortic insufficiency and then somebody with syphilis, then you're right there.
So the other thing I was thinking about as I looked at is the other thing that I teach and another teaching point is linear calcifications in the ascending aortic, which can be picked up on a chest x-ray. So if there was not any pronounced widened mediastinum, that's something that you can look for, and it's only really in the ascending aorta. And I noticed on the scan that there was calcification on the CT scan, and I was wondering, you know, where that correlated with on his chest x-ray. So the reason I bring it up is because sometimes that's been on internal medicine, actually, board reviews with linear calcifications.
They didn't call any calcifications on
his
chest x-ray.
Okay.
But with your, so you can teach me something now, Dr. Workowski. One of the things that when Daniel made his presentation that really caught my eye is that this is a 38-year-old man with calcific aortitis. And so we've seen plenty of calcific aortitis. I'm trying to think of whether I've seen it in 38-year-olds before.
Well, the issue is he had concomitant HIV. And, you know, we know HIV increases your risk of coronary disease. He didn't have coronary disease. And one of the other interesting things is that it can affect the coronary ostia. Not so much the coronary arteries, but the coronary ostia. And for some reason, it seems to affect the right versus the left more, and I'm not quite sure why, but it's really, looking at the pathology, which is really interesting, this was pretty fascinating pathology, and it would be per the normal that you wouldn't find the organism. So it's very rare, actually, to find the organism. And I thought it's very interesting to look at this pathology versus the first case. So what other things could do this in terms of your differential? I think you talked about Takayasu's. There's another rheumatic disease that can look like this, that can also look like this in terms of the presentation. That's ankylosing spondylitis. That can also look like this. So the other thinking about this going forward, would you, in terms of the treatment going forward, what would you think in terms of, I'll say this gentleman was penicillin allergic. How would you have handled this issue, and do we have data in terms of the penicillin allergic patient?
We can ask our OBGYN colleagues. <laughs> <laughs>
Yes, you can still desensitize them. You can still do the desensitize them and still do the appropriate treatment.
Okay. Any other alternative therapies that are available in the absence of desensitization or penicillin shortage? So as you know, that there's been rolling penicillin shortages as well. And so I wanted to bring up the issue because this has come up. I mean, I continue to get calls about penicillin shortages, both for IV penicillin and those of us that do IV every week, we have a shortage of something.
I would start off by saying, even before I went to alternative therapy, I would take a history, as is recommended in the CDC treatment guidelines, and ask what his manifestations of penicillin allergy were. A large proportion of patients, they are vague and unsubstantiated, and I would probably give him penicillin at that juncture. Then I would do just as Karen has suggested and desensitize him, perhaps. The alternative is that people have recommended and tried ceftriaxone in these settings, reasoning that cephalosporin antibiotics have somewhat less cross-reactivity. We did that again while I was at Hopkins in a study where we were treating patients for neurosyphilis who gave a history of penicillin allergy with ceftriaxone, and about 10 or 15% of those patients went on to anaphylaxis. So it's for people who have substantiated penicillin allergy, this is a very real consideration, and it's not something to be done in a cavalier way. But in, on the other hand, reversing that, over 80% of these patients can be treated with an antibiotic like ceftriaxone.
So I want to bring up the issue of, now we have a gentleman that has had syphilis once. What would be the panel's recommendation going forward in terms of screening for syphilis? A gentleman like this who's had syphilis once, who's had a horrible complication, and just thinking about patients in your HIV clinic, how often would you recommend screening with an RPR? Hillary?
I would screen him like I would my other HIV patients, because I would tie this to his original infection with, because he responded, his RPR decreased. It would make sense timing-wise, classic tertiary syphilis developing year, you know, 5 or more years later. And he just had his adequate treatment for secondary syphilis, but inadequate for widely disseminated infection years down the road. And I would base my health, my frequency of testing on his last 10 years of RPR, so, and STI history. So if he got gonorrhea every year, then he would be in my higher risk category, and I'd probably screen him every 3 months, like I probably would have already been doing. I don't think that this would have changed my idea of how often he should be screened for syphilis.
Karen?
Yeah, we're out of my purview.
Okay, Dr. Hook?
Well, we heard that he returned to his previous normal activities. whatever those might be. Having gotten syphilis once, he could get it again. I do think this is the opportunity. Dr. Workowski's question is really an important one. Yesterday, Ashley Chewett from Boston, previously of Toronto, presented interventions of syphilis based on the fact that targeting interventions because of issues related to the fact that people who have syphilis are at substantially increased risk to get it again. And if you look at your public health data, no less than 10%, more typically 15 to 20% of people in whom we diagnose early syphilis in have had it before. So this tendency to get recurring syphilis and so forth is an important thing for us to be aware of as clinicians and to use in our targeted screening. He has the, our patients with HIV get better health care than most of the other patients we see now. They have regular health care, they're checked regularly, and they're screened for a lot of diseases. And now, typically, that includes regular RPR testing, which I would advocate for this man.
So I'm just curious, from the audience standpoint, from a public health standpoint, how many folks that are in public health have existing protocols and have stratified per risk for screening for HIV-infected individuals or individuals that are at high risk? So I know some folks have done that regionally, but I think the point that I wanted to bring up is that I think we need to start to think that way. Our guidelines basically say 3 to 6 months depending on risk, but we don't go into depth on what that risk is. So I would be interested in anybody that has thought about this and in their institutions what they're doing in terms of screening, how they're determining what they're doing. I see Leandro here. I'm going to put him on the spot. In terms of what you guys are doing in your clinic for screening for people that have had prior syphilis. Microphone, Leandro.
While he's headed to the microphone,
the man
who's headed over here to the microphone is Dr. Leandro Mena from Mississippi, where Jackson, Mississippi, where he runs a very robust STD and HIV clinic.
Well, good morning. It's really interesting because I can tell you the tale of two different clinics. One is the Ryan White Foundation Clinic at the university, where most of the providers are infectious disease specialists or HIV providers, where sexual history is not done routinely, which means maybe it was done at the beginning, maybe not, and people screen for syphilis once a year because that's the protocol. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. most people get in January a once a year RPR. So at Open Arms, which is a LGBT kind of a emphasized clinic, most of our population is younger than 80% of the population is younger than 30 years old, and sexually transmitted infections and screening is a big part of what we do managing sexual health. So these patients, most of them, are sexually active, and they get screened, you know, every 3 months for gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis, and that's regardless of prior history. Of course, I mean, people with prior history, we may wait, you know, 6 months for the second RPR if someone notices it. But it's so routine that they will get an RPR every 3 months no matter what. So I think it depends on your population. I think you have to know your population because those case by case, you have to have a very, you know, any of us, you know, expert can do that judgment on the spot. Most clinicians taking care of HIV don't really think that way, and STDs are not in the priority. So I think the safest thing is to have, you know, protocols, right, that will standardize at least the approach, being what's best for your population.
I would just like to bring up a quick question. At WashU in St. Louis, our rates are high, we know that, and especially in our HIV patients. But with some of the changes for regular visits for HIV patients, some people are getting spaced out now from that every 3 months. And so what we're seeing is a lot of walk-in STD issues. We almost have a walk-in STD clinic for HIV patients and I'm actually greatly concerned about that. I used to see my patients every 3 months, and sometimes now they're getting spaced out to every four, every six, and I'm really quite afraid of how much activity we're going to miss.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and great comment. That reminds me, we actually tell our patients who are mechanized men, hey, just come every 3 months just to get screened for STDs. I mean, you're having, you know, more than two partners. The main issue is, you know, to make sure we detect this infection when we treat you as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. So we have on couple, you know, the STD screening for the mm-hmm. primary care visits.
Thank you. That's an excellent point.
Brenda Hill from the Virginia Department of Health. I'm public health nurse for our Peninsula Health District. And we screen all our positive syphilis cases. The persons who are HIV, we put them in a tickler file, whereas we follow them up 3, 6, 9, 12, and 24 months. And we do that on a regular basis.
I bring this up, and I appreciate you telling us that. I bring this up because I think it tends to get lost, especially amongst our HIV colleagues, in terms of thinking about this and putting it on their radar. So some of the things that we have done, besides you've done the tickler file, is have some kind of prompt if you don't have standing orders to remind people to ask those questions. I think that's kind of extremely important. I want to bring up a question for Karen, though, regarding the increases that we're seeing in syphilis in women in California in particular, and want to talk about the compliance with RPRs. I know this is a little bit off but it's still about screening and, you know, the increases that we're seeing in women, especially in California with the increases in congenital syphilis. And what can you tell us about the efforts in California to increase screening, especially in at-risk women?
So I'm going to ask also my PI to come up to the mic, too, and also answer that question. But I know that we are, you know, the concern is that I think Dr. Stolle presented that when you're looking at the epi, the women who are where it's happening are not, you know, entering prenatal care and entering prenatal care late. And so the question has been, are they being screened initially and at what time? And in terms of the efforts, I know that there was a lot going on in Fresno. She can probably comment to what we're trying to do to it's here. Yeah. No. Oh, who is Julie here? No. Yes, Ina can speak to what our efforts are.
Yeah, I mean, I think other than obviously, you know, I think the routinization of first prenatal care visit RPR.